café, chic, débutante, décor, à la carte, filet mignon, vinaigrette, savoir-faire, à la mode, déjà vu, cuisine, rendez-vous, buffet, chauffeur, sauter, c'est la vie.
Those are just a few of the French words and phrases that have made their way into our language, meaning that we all speak more French than we thought we did. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Next to English, French is the most widely learned language in the world. How did it become a language associated with snobbery, as we'll hear in a Saturday Night Live skit with Alec Baldwin as a snooty French teacher? What parts of the world speak French? And how does the language differ from country to country, region to region? Why are so many of our food words stolen from French? What aspects of French language and culture are simply untranslatable? Joining me to discuss the joy of French is Sage Gellner, professor of French in the UW-Madison's Division of Continuing Studies. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Emily. Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start with some facts about the French language. I didn't know until thinking about this program with you that more people learned French than a lot of the other languages that we might think of, like Spanish or German or Chinese or something. I did not know that it was the second most learned language in the world.
Yeah, behind English, it is the second most studied language in the world. And it is a language that's spoken on all five continents. So I like to say that it's a horizontal language, a global language. It is the sixth world language after English, Chinese, English, Spanish, Arabic, and Hindi. Then comes French.
In terms of numbers of people
speaking it? In terms of numbers of people speaking it, yes.
And why do so many people learn French as their second language then?
Well, it depends on the context. It may be for pleasure, which is certainly the people I work with in our adult evening classes. It may be because it's the official language of the country, the language of administration. It may be because I'm thinking of West African and Northern African countries. It may be that it is required, as it is in many Canadian provinces, Quebec especially.
Well, and I guess I was struck with those words you were saying at the beginning, like café and chic and, you know, décor and so on, this idea that there are so many French words in our language so that even if somebody doesn't take French, if you speak English, you're actually speaking quite a bit of French. Give us some sense of other words that we say all the time or phrases we use all the time that we just sort of do it as part of our language without recognizing that it's French.
Yeah, so I like to joke that sometimes there's more French in English than there is English in English. And so a lot of people are used to thinking about English as a Latin-based or a Germanic-based language. And it's true that our grammar is based on German, but so much of our vocabulary comes from French. So it's estimated that a third to half of our vocabulary comes from French. So the examples that we had in the beginning, those are words that are used on a daily basis that are just, you know, directly taken from the French language. Some other ones that we might think of are tête-à-tête, résumé, largesse. Those are some other examples. And then there are the cognates. And so these are words that are twinned in form and meaning. So a few examples of those are abandon, garage, lieutenant, magnitude, satisfaction, parasol, yacht, zigzag. I mean,
just... Okay, wait. So how are those French? Explain that. So how is zigzag French?
So it's a word that means and is spelled the exact same way in French and in English. So it's le zigzag in French.
Okay. And it started with the French and we just stole it.
I'm not sure about zigzag.
Okay. But a lot of the other ones are ones that have just come into our language and
That's
we just
right.
pronounce them in a different way.
That's right. So they were probably, many of them were originally Latin, right? Filtered down through French and now are in use in English. And it's estimated that an English speaker, an average English speaker, already knows about 15,000 of these words. So that means that when we speak English, we're speaking a lot of French.
It seems as if the French words are the ones that sound fancy-dancy and refined and civilized, you know, words like buffet or cuisine or something, as opposed to ones that come out of the, I don't know, dirt.
Right.
You know, why is that? Why do we have this sense of French as being the language that's fancy?
Well, I think it goes back to a historical event, and that is 1066, the Battle of Hastings, when William the Conqueror landed on the beaches of southern England. And so this was a Norman king, and he, with his conquest, Norman French became the language of the court and stayed that way for about 300 years. And so for English speakers, there is this kind of love-hate relationship with the French language, and French has historically then denoted this idea of aristocracy and upper class and refinement and sophistication. These are some of the connotations that French has had. It's really interesting. I'm reading Harry Potter with one of my children right now, and this kind of love-hate relationship is apparent even in the works of J.K. Rowling, because the villains have French names, Malfoy and Voldemort. So It endures to this day.
And in some of the novels that I teach, like by Jane Austen or the Brontes, British novelists, often the French characters are the ones that are frivolous. They're either fops or,
yes,
you know, something about them is not quite as sturdy and serious and down to earth as the English gentlemen and women in the novels. So they're often coquettes.
Yes, there's another French word. Yes.
So all aside from the sort of the fact that it came out of a association with an aristocracy and so on, but doesn't it actually sound fancier too? I mean, all aside from any background or history with it, it does seem to me that, but maybe this is conditioning, but that there's a kind of musicality that when you say something like buffet or ballet or, you know, filet, that it sounds more delicate.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not a linguist, but so can't really speak to the origins of it and such, but there are maybe more vowel sounds, maybe a sense of fluidity that English and German and more consonant-based languages have more punctuation and staccato in the rhythm.
And you almost have to spit when you speak German, at least I do. I mean, so there's a sort of, with French, it seems like you can sound like you're very upper class. And I don't know how much of that is what we're conditioned to. I wonder if you can set up the marvelous skit that Alec Baldwin did when he was on Saturday Night Live, because I think that'll be a good point of departure for discussing some of the stereotypes about French.
Absolutely. So this is a skit that dates from the time of Chris Farley, so it's a little bit dated, but still very, very funny and very relevant. And so this is Alec Baldwin playing the part of a French teacher, and he's really playing on this stereotype that there is proper French and that we have to speak French in a certain way. And so we can just have a listen and have a laugh.
Bonjour, Monsieur Norbeck.
Bonjour, Monsieur Norbeck.
Mais oui, je m'appelle Monsieur Norbeck. Et vous? Comment vous appelez-vous? Répondez. Je m'appelle...
Je m'appelle Robert.
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 Et quel jour est-il aujourd'hui?
I gotta go to the bathroom.
En français.
Je gotta go.
Nah. Je voudrais aller à la salle de bain.
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 Et quelle heure est-il, Monsieur Curtis? Quelle heure est-il?
Like 8.
En français.
Il est 8. Where is?
Il est 8 heures.
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 Yeah. En français, il est 8 heures.
I gotta make a phone call.
Ah. Qu'est-ce que c'est? I...
En français.
Je voudrais téléphoner beaucoup de filles. Je voudrais téléphoner beaucoup de filles. J'ai bleu blé, téléphoné. Bleu. Et où est la bibliothèque? Monsieur Briand.
Oh, man, I'm sorry. I swear, I was at the nurse. I had to sign up for this.
Ah, en français. Je suis allé voir l'infirmière parce que je pense faire une demande.
Je la bada hou, que ya bada hou, bada 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 hou, bada 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 hou, boulala.
Bien classé, répétez, s'il vous plaît.
Je la bada hou.
Très bien.
That's a hilarious skit. Tell us, as a French teacher, what you kind of get from that.
Well, I wouldn't be a very good French teacher if I didn't point out that there were several inaccuracies in Alec Baldwin's delivery. I think it captures a certain kind of learning of French, kind of the old school, where there's a lot of emphasis on that pronunciation, which really is very hard for Anglophones to get. French is an easy language to learn to read and to learn to write and even to understand, but it's that production, the oral production, that's really hard.
This notion, I mean, I think what's funny is when, say, the Chris Farley character in that skit or Adam Sandler, some of the others, or they're the one that said, I have to go to the bathroom, it sounds so down to earth compared to the doo-doo-doo kind of,
yeah.
Even the tone of voice carries with it a snootiness, which I think goes along with the perception, and you'll have to clarify how much of it is a real perception as opposed to a stereotype, that the French do not like to have their language butchered by Americans or anyone else who are trying to learn French, so that rather than feeling like you're going to get praise for trying to speak French when you're visiting France, you might feel that you're going to be criticized for how dare, almost as if you're committing blasphemy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the French take their language very seriously. They have for many centuries now. However, I do think that characterization of them not being patient or forgiving with people who are trying to speak their language, I think that's changing. I think there's a generation shift happening in France. France is the number one tourist destination in the world. I mean, more people go to France than any other country. And so the French people have had to change this perception about them. And I think they're happy when you try to speak French. They might not show it in the ways that we're used to, but they appreciate it.
Well, tell us about the French Academy, though, because I thought that they were working very hard to keep English out of French. In other words, to not have le weekend or something, to not have words come into French that aren't really French.
Yeah, so this is the governing body of learned people on the French language, and this is what this is an example of the French taking their language very, very seriously. It was founded in 1635 under the reign of Louis XIII by his cardinal, Richelieu, who is also known as l'Eminence Rouge, or the Red Eminence, because of the red capes he would wear. And this was, in a way, an attempt to coalesce power for the king, a way to codify and standardize the French language. What a lot of people don't realize, maybe, is that French is the French language and the French identity has always had to establish itself in relation to its external others, so England, Germany, Spain, but also its internal others. So there are very deep, deep regional identities in France. So there is Brittany, there's Gascony, there's the Basque part of France, there's Provence. And each of these places had its own language or dialect. So there has always been this attempt to codify, standardize, and get a pure French. And so that's a bit what Richelieu was trying to do when he created the academy. So yes, these are this is a group of about 700 people. They're called Les Immortels because they are, when they are elected, they have their job for life. It's very old Europe, very a lot of pomp and circumstance. They have special uniforms, and they have a special ceremonial sword, and they take their job very, very seriously. And it is in part to standardize, codify, and weed out terms from other languages and other expressions from other languages, English in particular, especially with the meteoric rise of the digital age and all the technology that comes with it. So they don't want to say email. They want French people to say courrier électronique. So
instead of you've got mail, it would be you've got blah, blah, blah.
But what do French people on the street do? They say email, right? They say blog, okay. They say web instead of le toile. So there's a French language in theory, which is the academy's version, and a French language in practice. And I mean, French people really, they love English. They want to speak English. English is exotic and fun and cool. So,
and is it kind of a generational change then, with mostly the insistence on keeping the words out coming from, like you say, a little bit more of the old school French?
I think the Academy still wants to, you know, keep a certain kind of French, a standard French. But again, it's theory and practice.
How about in the school system for French children?
Oh, in the school system? Yeah, I mean, it's not only are there English terms, there's a lot of slang. Verlan, or it's a little bit like pig Latin. Verlan is an inversion of l'envers, which means inverse. So when you invert your words. So this is a kind of a slang that is spoken by the French youth that can be indistinguishable for some native French speakers.
If you keep a lot of words out of the language, it's also going to be a smaller language. How does French compare to English in terms of just sheer number of words?
Oh, I don't have the statistic on me, but I believe it's 2/3 more vocabulary in English than in French.
Because I was just thinking, with English being a language that borrows and steals and takes words from all over the place, that it does give it a kind of variety and scope that maybe is not there if you protect the integrity of your own language origins.
That's right.
And so presumably sometimes there might be a term where there's only one word for it in French and maybe four or five in English.
Exactly. So I'm a gardener, and so an example I like to use is that in English there's a specific word for the plant that you don't want in your garden, and that is weed. In French it's simply mauvaise herbe, or bad plant, bad grass. So you'll have a lot of examples like this.
Where it might take two French words to two or three to say what would be just one different word in English.
Right.
And a personal question, why did you gravitate toward teaching French and making French literature and French language your area of expertise if you're not from France?
So I grew up in northern Wisconsin, and my family has German background, and my parents both spoke German. My grandparents spoke German, not first-generation German speakers, but German was sort of the lingua franca in the household, and I wanted something different. I wanted to broaden my horizons, and started taking French in high school, went and lived in Corsica for a month when I was 15. And then I was struck with an incurable case of francophilia. And that sort of set the trajectory for the rest of my professional life.
It's interesting, the phrase you use too, lingua franca. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so lingua franca is an ancestor of French, and used around the Mediterranean basin from, let's see, maybe the 10th to the 16th centuries. And this is a kind of a patois
trade language used by traders and sailors, again, along the Mediterranean.
But it's just interesting that the phrase we use in English to say sort of the common language, or
right,
the language of currency, or the language that we can use as our base, that's a phrase that really means French language if you translate it directly.
Right.
Lingua franca. Yet another example of how we're speaking French, even if we don't know it.
Right.
More on French and the different kinds of French you find around the world when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Ça dépend de quel coin vous venez du Québec. Il y a des endroits où vraiment, là, comme au Saguenay, ils prononcent vraiment tout ce qui est A, ils disent O, comme pas des patates, des potates. Potates.
Ah oui, patate, la patate.
Ah, vous dites une pas les potates.
Une patate, une patate. Je sais pas.
C'est vrai qu'ils ont un accent particulier. Ah, pire que les Belges encore, parce que les Belges savent encore, mais les Canadiens, on a du mal à comprendre.
That's two speakers of French from Quebec. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Sage Gellner, and we are talking about the joy of French. And that's French not only in France, but in many places around the world. You were talking, Sage, about sort of Francophone languages, the fact that we have French in different countries, different, I think you said all five continents that... Mm-hmm. Well, we don't have French in Antarctica or, you know, certain places, but in five continents, there are places where French is spoken as either the national language or quite prevalently. And for those of us, I mean, I had French in high school, but I confess I can't tell the difference between the Quebec speakers that we just heard and French speakers, and speakers from Haiti and from Martinique, and it all sounds like French. And so did Alec Baldwin. I didn't catch the mistakes that you heard in the Saturday Night Live skit. But tell us something about the number of French languages that there are and how they differ from each other.
I mean, there are it's just a galaxy of different kinds of French around the world. And I think that's a generational shift too, that I think an older generation might have this impression that French comes from France and specifically from Paris. But with globalization and the world becoming closer, French is just another tool that people use to communicate, especially in Canada and in Africa. So in the African countries.
In some ways, it's always a bit startling when you hear, whether it's French or English or German, being spoken in Africa or in South America or somewhere else. It's startling in the sense of the reminder of the painful legacy of colonialism. You know, if you find a language being spoken where it was not natural for it to be spoken there, and you know that it is the result of conquest, it can make you feel a little uncomfortable. So tell us about some of the ways in which French is being spoken in places because of French imperialism.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you brought that out, because that's a part of the history of French that is very painful. It is very, very tragic, and it's something, the repercussions we are dealing with it even today. So the spread of French globally was due to, as you said, colonization, domination, and exploitation of foreign peoples outside of France. And unlike with British paternalism, more paternalistic models, the French colonizing approach was that of complete assimilation through education. So the French were carrying out, well into the 19th century, carrying out their mission civilisatrice, or civilizing mission, in places like Algeria and Burkina Faso and Senegal, promoting the idea that their language and culture was far superior to the indigenous languages and cultures.
So they were doing their colonialism through education, through the schools, and the French language was a very important tool for empire building. And the French colonial administration had really ugly terms for this. They called the colonial elites, so the people they put, the indigenous people they put into power, they called those people les évolués, or the evolved ones. So it's even embedded in the terms itself. And the Algerian writer, Kateb Yassine, for example, he called speaking French and going to French school an entrée dans la gueule du loup, or being thrown into the wolf's gaping jaws. And so you really have this wrenching away from maternal language and culture and these narratives of alienation and trauma in this generation of post-colonial writers writing in French. On the other hand, French, again, is a tool for them to express this. So some of them, it's just very interesting to see their relationship to the French language.
And I can see that it is both a sort of painful legacy and then also an entree, there's another French word,
yes,
into a kind of educated upper-class society. If you are fluent in French and are coming from somewhere like Senegal or Burkina Faso, it immediately gives you a certain cachet. There's another
yes.
French word. It gives you something that people are trying to study as part of their graduate school or something else. They have one of the languages that is looked up to as one of the elite languages of the world.
Absolutely. And language in any context, eloquence is a tool for social advancement, and especially in the case of French.
We started with a little clip of speakers from Quebec. Can you talk about the sort of special case of Canada and French?
Sure. So the rise in of French, or the presence of French, is due to French exploration of the New World, as we know. So this is about the same time the French Academy was being created. Champlain was traveling to the New World and setting up settlements in Quebec and in other places. And French explorers would then go on to name the places that they saw and the natural phenomena that they saw. And here are some more French words in English from this time period: butte, levee, depot, bison. And a little known fact, I believe, is that Wisconsin, the name of our state, is a derivative of Wisconsin, which is a French derivative of an American Indian term for the territory. So it was really the fur trade that brought French to the northern America.
And it's interesting when you talk about the native language that the French sort of did a spin on for Wisconsin and so on. And of course, with English coming over and French coming over, both of them are imports here.
Right.
Now, both of them are sort of foreign, if we look at it that way. What about other areas of the United States where French is spoken, such as pockets in Louisiana? And we celebrate Mardi Gras.
Right.
And so on. But tell us some other, we've got obviously the whole Quebec and the dual language in Canada, but what about within the United States?
Well, so Louisiana is a great example, a sort of bastion of French in North America. So this was the result of the expulsion of the Acadians in the 1750s, when the British conquerors sought to impose Protestantism and English on a Roman Catholic and French-speaking people. So this is referred to as le grand dérangement, the great movement. And this is when the Acadians went down the Mississippi River and eventually settled in Louisiana. So these are modern-day Cajuns. And then the other kind of French spoken in Louisiana is Creole French, which is more related to Spanish and native languages. In the U.S., Maine is a little-known pocket of French heritage speakers, because around 1820, when Maine became a state, there were masses or a large number of immigrants coming from Quebec and New Brunswick to work in the forests of Maine and also in the textile mills. So there were quite a few, quite a large population of heritage speakers in Maine.
Hmm. So let's talk about French in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Where is it found, and how does the sound of French and the use of French in those African countries differ from what you would find in France or in Quebec or in Louisiana?
The sound of... There are many different African French versions. So when people talk about people from Africa having an African accent, that's a problem. And I think the clip that we will listen to will show that there are many different African accents in French. So Senegalese sounds different from Ivoirien, from Côte d'Ivoire, French spoken in the Côte d'Ivoire. African French spoken in Africa will, again, as in any linguistic situation, borrow from the other languages around it. So it may have, in North Africa, it may have Arabic expressions. In Senegal, it might have Poular expressions or Wolof expressions. So a very interesting sort of laboratory, living laboratory of language, and not nearly as many hang-ups about what belongs and what doesn't as in the French Academy would be fussing about.
So we're going to hear sort of a medley of French spoken in different African countries.
Right.
Pour moi, le français, c'est une langue de communication. C'est celle qui nous permet ici, à ces jeux, de pouvoir communiquer, de pouvoir dialoguer.
Tu as mangé. Oh, chez nous, on dit, tu as mangé, tu vois. Donc, c'est l'action-là. Et pas seulement dire, tu as mangé. On nous dit, tu as mangé.
T'as compris, d'ailleurs. T'as compris, ma copine? Ça, ce sont les Ivoiriens qui parlent comme ça. Ils aiment mettre le dé.
C'est d'autres qui le disent. Moi-même, je ne peux pas dire comment est-ce que je parle.
Je mange de la banane. Ça, c'est typiquement camerounais.
Par exemple, je vais te parler quoi? C'est ça, les Burkinabés, là, c'est comme cela qu'ils vont parler. Parce que les Burkinabés sont en français, là, c'est pas comme cela, quoi.
Can you tell me a little bit about what we just heard there, then?
So we heard a variety of speakers talking about how they speak French. And we have to remember, so from Côte d'Ivoire, Burkina Faso, I think, was represented. Cameroon was represented. And so we have to remember that in Africa, French is likely not the native language. It's the language of school. So they were all talking about how what French is to them and how they speak in French.
It makes me wish I knew French. I mean, why is it that if I've had 6 years of French in middle school, high school, here in Madison and class in college, why can I not understand much of any of what was just spoken? That's sad.
It's a practice, right? It's a daily practice, and language learning is a lifelong pursuit. And I think it would come back really quickly, okay. Especially because you have that background. But it is a question of tuning your ear to different kinds of French. I remember being just chagrined when I went to Montreal after I had lived in France. I had studied in, you know, at the Sorbonne, and you know, I was considered myself fluent, right? And I go to Montreal, and two humbling things happened. They started speaking, and I couldn't understand. And then I started speaking, and they instantly switched to English. But my ear got much better, and I started to really understand the different kinds of French spoken in the province of Quebec. And I really think that, you know, the Quebecois accent is often held up for ridicule. Accents are... But they are markers of identity. And for me, the different kinds of French spoken around the world, they're just beautiful to me. It's just the different rhythms and the places people are coming from, literally and figuratively, and the way that's expressed through their French.
And I suppose in English we have the same, where you have the English of Great Britain, of America, of Australia, of New Zealand, and even within this country you have Southern accents and, you know, different kinds of Englishes.
Absolutely.
All around the world. Is there a sort of gold standard of what French is supposed to sound like?
Yeah, people from Tours in French. Tours is kind of the Midwest of France, not in any other way besides accent, but that's where news anchors will go to perfect their French for being on TV. And Emily, you mentioned that you have different accents in the English-speaking world and in the U.S., and so you definitely have different accents within France. And this last clip we're going to hear is an example of the accent de Marseille, which is a very different, again, a sort of a singing accent
the French say in French.
Qu'est-ce que c'est qui vous gêne? Non, dites-le. Vous voulez pas le dire? Je vais vous le dire, moi, ce qui vous gêne depuis que j'ai commencé. C'est l'accent. Mais qu'est-ce que vous voulez que je fasse? Que je perde mon accent? Que j'arrête de parler avec les mains? Et pourquoi pas que j'arrête d'exagérer aussi pendant qu'on y est? Vous voulez que je vous dise la vérité? J'ai essayé. J'y arrive pas. C'est comme si on me demandait de marcher sans les jambes. Dis donc, Jean-François, pour aller à Barbès ce soir, on change la marque d'un coup.
Now, is that speaker making fun of himself a bit?
He's talking about, as though this is a comic from Marseille, speaking to a largely Parisian audience, and he's saying, what is bothering you about how I'm speaking? It's my accent. And what do you want me to do about it? You want me to get rid of it? I tried. I cannot. It would be like asking me to walk without my legs.
Okay. And that would be equivalent to somebody speaking who sounds like they're from the Bronx or from Mississippi or from somewhere where it might trigger a kind of laughter, if it's especially done in an exaggerated way.
Yes.
Interesting. There is, it seems to me, a kind of international French language that is the language of cooking.
Yes.
Can you talk about why it is that so many of our French words that there's so many of our words for cooking come right from the French, and give us some examples?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned before, it's the Norman conquest, right? And this is where the origin for so many of our cooking words in French comes from. For example, the words for the animals that we eat, they became doubled with this conquest. So for example, the words for cow, pig, and deer, so these were Anglo-Saxon words used by the serfs or the people who took care of them in the field. And then the lords used the French words of beef, pork, and venison, so bœuf, porc, et venaison, for the same items being eaten at the table. So that's an example of how there came to be more words in for cuisine using the French in English. But it's true. I think it also has to do with French cuisine having an international reputation and just, you know, being some of the delicious food. Oh, there's my bias showing again on the planet. But some of the most delicious food. But so if we just take the bees, for example, we have to blanch, we have bouquet garni. The seas, we have crepes, we have, back to the bees, we have bouillon, right? We have sauté, we have so many of our cooking words come from the French.
And you could probably take a very plain dish, something that's an ordinary meat and potatoes kind of dish, but give it a fancy French name on a menu, you can up the price, right?
Yeah, tack on a couple bucks.
Same with the drinks, perhaps.
Yes.
If it's a Chardonnay or whatever.
Definitely.
It simply sounds like it would cost more.
Yes.
Are there other examples besides food where you see sort of a cluster of French words?
I think that dance has a lot of, well, and
sure,
certainly ballet has all of its terms are in French, no matter where you're studying dance. Fashion, the fashion world, also has a number of different words in
what
French.
What are some examples, like lingerie or
like
clothing items? And and certainly also maybe things like cosmetics, like cologne. And
yes.
And again, if you put a fancy French name, the perfume sounds as if it should.
Right.
You know.
Right.
We are going to talk about learning French and about what happens when adults from around the world take to French late in life, how that changes not only the way they sound, but also the way they think. More when we return with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Sage Gellner, and we are talking about the joy of French. Let's talk about people who were not born speaking French or didn't grow up in a country where French was a sort of a accepted second language of the whole country, but those who came to French accidentally or as adults later for some reason and how it affected them. I know you work with adult students when you teach French through the Division of Continuing Studies, but I'm also thinking about just people around the world that come to French, especially writers that might come to French.
Yeah, it's a genre that interests me a lot. It's not just not the standard sort of midlife crisis. I'm moving to France. I'm moving to Provence, but it's a little bit deeper. It's a memoir of coming to French, the French language, along with the culture in France or another Francophone country. And so, a few people I've read are Alice Kaplan, and she's a professor at Yale, and she writes. She published a book in the 1990s called French Lessons, where she writes about learning French as a girl and the sort of romantic vision she had of France and Europe. And then in her graduate work and her later research, she started working on Belgian and French fascist intellectuals and sort of digging in deeper to the darker side of her chosen language, anti-Semitism in that case. I'm really enjoying following the work of Ta-Nehisi Coates. He's a writer and a senior editor for The Atlantic. And in 2008, he published a memoir called The Beautiful Struggle. And he writes about politics and history and race and culture. What I find really interesting is that he dropped everything in the summer of 2014 to go to Middlebury's French immersion program to get back into his French. And he did this because, as a writer, he wanted to explore this part of his skills, to add to his skills, I think, and for other reasons. So now he's working a lot in France, and he's a fellow for the American Library in Paris. And he's another person I really enjoy reading his experience with the French language, because as a black, an African American man, French sort of epitomizes, in some people's minds, white privilege. And to see him navigating through this is very interesting.
And it's interesting to hear him talk about it. Let's take a listen.
I took French when I was in seventh grade, during the period of my book, The Beautiful Struggle, which begins right about that time. And I cut up a fool in that class. I was the worst French student in the world. Ah, il fait chaud, il fait froid, blah, blah, blah. Just a horrible, horrible, horrible student. And one of the things I think about, I would have been 12 at that time, same age as my son right now, who is coincidentally, and I didn't remember that, I didn't even make that connection, who right now is in an immersion camp for French just outside of Paris for 6 weeks and is absolutely loving it. And I think about the difference between me and him. And one of the big differences is my son is in a world in which he understands French as a functional thing. He knows people who are on his soccer team who speak French, some of their parents are French. He knows his mother studied French when she was in college. He knows his mother visited Paris and absolutely loved Paris. He knows that his mother loved Paris so much that she actually convinced his father to go to Paris, you know, to see what this was all about. Because when my wife came to Paris, I was, okay, if you want to go to Paris, fine. Who goes to Paris? Whatever. That was my mindset. You understand? And I was a writer even then. This was not like when I was like 13 or 14 and right off the block. I was a writer then, and I didn't get it. And I didn't get it because I had been exposed to so little. And I look at my son, who's been exposed to so much more, and gets it like right away. And it really is a statement to me. And it really makes me feel how happy I am that I was offered the opportunity to grow up to be 37 years old. Because I think about how so many young people who I grew up around would not have that opportunity.
So for Coates, then, French is sort of, it's privilege, it's access, it's joining something that he didn't think was open to him.
Yes, yes. And it's very powerful. And I think it's interesting that he talks about his son. And again, I think the millennials and Generation Z, they're going to increasingly see French as a tool. French as a tool for communication, and maybe less of this baggage or the romanticization that we have had. I think, it's a language of privilege historically, and I think he makes a good point too, in other writings, that it is a privilege to learn another language, to be reborn and be renewed in this way, to discover yourself in another language.
How would you argue, I mean, I'm just going to play devil's advocate for a bit. What about the case that could be made that, you know, why is he learning French rather than tracing back his roots and learning Swahili or learning the language of Senegambia? Or, you know, do we, by giving French a kind of status as somehow above languages in other places in the world, are we perpetuating the very aspects of colonialism that we are trying to get past?
That's an excellent, very probing and deep question, Emily. And it's one that Coates is grappling with, and writers, international writers worldwide, are grappling with. In the words of Audre Lorde, it is using the master's tools to look inside of and dismantle the master's house, I think.
I suppose you appropriate it and you use it in whatever way you can. Most languages have these unique features that make it hard to translate it at certain points, where there's just this perfect word, or there's a way poetry can be written. There's sounds that can't be duplicated. If you have to translate from French into English, where do you find those moments where it's really tough to go from the French to the English without losing a lot?
I think the very first thing that English speakers have to wrap their minds around is the forms of address. And that's the you form. In French, it has two different forms. It has the informal tu and the formal vous, right? And so tu is used with children and pets and people you know well, your best friends. And vous is used with your boss, your boyfriend's parents.
Teachers,
anyone who's older than you are, unless they have given you the right or the permission to tutoie them. So that's kind of a linguistic and cultural thing that gets, you know, that's difficult to translate. This is, of course, most prevalent in metropolitan France. In Quebec, everybody just uses tu. So everybody just uses you. It's very North American in that flattening of social hierarchies kind of way. So that's one part of it. A word that I love to talk about is flâner, which really has no really good English equivalent. Loosely translated, it means to stroll. So this is a word that was invented in the 19th century, and it's a very distinctly French word. It's a very distinctly Parisian word, and it's the idea of just walking leisurely and taking in the sounds and the sights around you without a particular destination or goal. And so it can be in the masculine form, it can be a noun as well, a flâneur. And why not? Let's fly in the face of the academy and make it feminine, la flâneuse.
Well, and that brings up the point too, that in English we don't have to worry about whether a noun is, you know, masculine or feminine, and then the Germans throw in neuter.
Right.
But so that if you have a fork, a knife, and a spoon, you got to figure out which one's masculine and feminine.
Right.
So that's English in some ways is simpler in that way. You don't have to worry about gender.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I always tell my students, though, you have a 50-50 chance. So those are pretty good odds.
What about a word such as chez, or as another word?
Yeah. So chez is an interesting preposition that has no real equivalent in English. It can be translated as at the home of. So when you're invited chez quelqu'un, you're invited into their home. But there's a sense of intimacy and a different sense of public-private space with this preposition. For example, you don't go to the doctor, you go chez le docteur. You go chez le dentiste, because these are people, hopefully, who know you well. And also, if you are going out to a restaurant, the name might be chez Jean-Pierre or chez Nanou.
Let's hear a little bit of another French language learner talking about this sort of different sound when you try to put French into English, and that would be David Sedaris.
Yes. So David Sedaris is an American humorist. He writes on a variety of topics. He writes for The New Yorker. But his memoir of French language learning is called Me Talk Pretty One Day. And it's just, there are parts of it that are just hilarious. So he moves to France with his boyfriend, Hugh, and he undertakes learning French. And there are just, it's just very funny.
This is a little segment of a story. I moved to France 3 years ago, and I enrolled in an international school that promised to teach me the language. And we were only allowed to speak French in the class, and I was the only American in there. So this is a little part of a story called Jesus Shaves. It was my second month of French class, and the teacher was leading us in an exercise designed to promote the use of one, our latest personal pronoun. And what does one do on Easter, she asked. Would anyone like to tell us? An Italian nanny was attempting to answer the question when our Moroccan student interrupted, shouting, "Excuse me, but what is some Easter?" The teacher then called upon the rest of us to explain. The Poles led the charge to the best of their ability. It is, said one, a party for the little boy of God who call himself Jesus, and she faltered, and her fellow countrymen came to her aid. He call himself Jesus, and then he die one day on two morsels of lumber. The rest of the class jumped in, offering bits of information that would have given the Pope an aneurysm. He die one day, and then he go above of my head to live with your father. Jesus weared of himself the long hair, and after he died the first day, he come back here for to say hello to the peoples. He nice the Jesus. Jesus make the good thing, and on the Easter we be sad because somebody make him dead today. Part of the problem had to do with vocabulary. Simple nouns such as cross and resurrection were beyond our grasp, let alone such complicated reflexive phrases as to give of yourself your only begotten son.
That reminds me of this great essay Mark Twain wrote, too, where his comic piece was translated into French, and then he translated it back from the French into English because they hadn't found it funny. So much was lost in translation,
right. Which
is a good case for why we need to learn the language, right? Why we need to study French with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Each language has its unique features.
Yes.
Thanks so much for sharing the joy of French with us. Let's go out on a song. I'm Emily Auerbach with Sage Gellner, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. And here is Edith Piaf. De tous les jours, et ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur une part de bonheur dont je connais la cause. C'est toi pour moi, moi pour toi dans la vie. Tu me l'as dit. Aperçois, alors je sens dans moi mon